"Well, now, my dear sir," said Jack to Stephen, "what do you say to a little music, if your ears are not quite numbed? Is it any good inviting you, Dylan? Mr. Marshall has the deck at present, I believe."
"Thank you, sir, thank you very much, but you know what a sad waste music is on me. Pearls before swine."
"I am really pleased with tonight's exercise," said Jack, tuning his fiddle. "Now I feel I can run inshore with a clearer conscience without risking the poor sloop too much."
"I'm happy you're pleased, and certainly the mariners seem to ply their pieces with a wonderful dexterity, but you must allow me to insist that that note is not A."
"Ain't it?" cried Jack anxiously. "Is this better?" Stephen nodded, tapped his foot three times, and they dashed away into Mr. Brown's Menorcan divertimento. "Did you notice my bowing in the pump, pump, pump piece?" asked Jack.
"I did indeed, very sprightly, very agile. I noticed you neither struck the hanging shelf nor yet the lamp, and I only grazed the locker once myself."
"I believe the great thing is not to think of it. Those fellows rattling their guns in and out didn't think of it. Clapping onto the tackle, sponging, swabbing, ramming, it's grown quite mechanical. I'm very pleased with them, particularly 3 and 5 of the port broadside. They were the merest parcel of lubbers to begin with, I do assure you."
"You are wonderfully earnest to make them proficient."
"Well, yes, there's not a moment to be lost." "Well, you do not find this sense of constant hurry oppressive? Jading?" "Lord, no, it's as much part of our life as salt pork, even more so in tide flow waters. Anything can happen in 5 minutes' time at sea. You should hear Lord Nelson. In this case of gunnery, a single broadside can bring down a mast and so win a fight. And there's no telling from 1 hour to the next when we may have to fire it. There's no telling at sea."
"How profoundly true. An all-seeing eye, an eye that could pierce the darkness, would have beheld the track of the Spanish frigate Cacafuego running down to Cartagena. A track that certainly would have cut the Sophies if the sloop had not lingered a quarter of an hour to douse her lighted casks. But as it was, the Cacafuego passed silently 1.5 miles to the westward of the Sophie, and neither caught sight of the other. The same eye would have seen a good many other vessels in the neighbourhood of Cape Nao, for, as Jack knew very well, everything coming up from Almeria, Alicante or Malaga had to round that headland. It would particularly have noticed a small convoy bound for Valencia under the protection of a letter of marque. And it would have seen that the Sophie's course, if persisted in, would bring her inshore and to the windward of the convoy in the half hour before first light."
"Sir! Sir!" piped Babington into Jack's ear.
"Hush, sweetheart," murmured his captain, whose dreaming mind was occupied with quite another sex.
"Eh? Mr. Dillon says top lights in the offing, sir." "Ha!" said Jack, instantly awake, and ran up on to the grey deck in his nightshirt.
"Good morning, sir," said James, saluting and offering his nightglass.
"Good morning, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, touching his nightcap in reply and taking the telescope. "Where away?"
"Right on the beam, sir."
"By God, you've good eyes," said Jack, lowering the glass, wiping it and peering again into the shifting sea haze. "Two? Three? I think a fourth." The Sophie was lying there, hove to, with her foretopsail to the mast and her main topsail almost full, the one counterbalancing the other as she lay right under the dark cliff. The wind, what wind there was a puffy, unreliable air from the north-northwest, smelling of the warm hillside. But presently, as the land grew warmer, it would no doubt veer to the northeast, or even, frankly, into the east itself. Jack gripped the shrouds. "Let us consider the positions from the top," he said. "God damn and blast these skirts!"
The light increased. The thinning haze unveiled five vessels in a straggling line, or rather heap. They were all hull up, and the nearest was no more than a quarter of a mile away. From north to south they ran. First, the Gloire, a very fast ship-rigged Toulon privateer with 12 8-pounders, chartered by a wealthy Barcelona merchant named Jaime Mateu to protect his two settees, the Pardal and the Zalak, of 6 guns apiece, the second carrying a valuable and illegal cargo of uncustomed quicksilver into the bargain. The Pardal lay under the privateer's quarter to leeward. Then, almost abreast of the Pardal but to windward, and only 400 or 500 yards from the Sophie, the Santa Lucia, a Neapolitan snow, a prize belonging to the Gloire, filled with disconsolate French royalists, taken on their passage to Gibraltar. Then came the second settee, the Zalak. And lastly, a tartan that had joined the company off Alicante, glad of the protection from Barbary rovers, Minorcan letters of marque, and British cruisers. They were all smallish vessels. They all expected danger from the seaward, which was why they kept inshore, an uncomfortable, perilous way of getting along compared with the long course of the open sea, but one that allowed them to run for the shelter of coastal batteries. And if any of them noticed the Sophie in the stronger light, they said, "Why, a little brig creeping along close to the land. For Dania, no doubt."
"What do you make of the ship?" asked Jack.
"I cannot count her ports in this light. She seems a little small for one of their 18-gun corvettes. But at all events she is of some force, and she is the watchdog."
"Yes."
That was certain. She lay there to the windward of the convoy as the wind veered and as they rounded the cape. Jack's mind was beginning to move fast. The flowing series of possibilities ran smoothly before his judgment. He was both the commander of that ship and of this sloop under his feet.
"May I make a suggestion, sir?"
"Yes,"
said Jack in a flat voice. "So long as we don't hold a council of war, they never decide anything." He had asked Dillon up here as an attention due to him for having detected the convoy. He really didn't want to consult him or any other man. And he hoped Dillon wouldn't break in on his racing ideas with any remarks whatever, however wise. Only one person could deal with this, the Sophie's master and commander.
"Perhaps I should beat to quarters, sir,"
said James stiffly, for the hint had been eminently clear. "You see that slovenly little snow between us and the ship?" said Jack, breaking across him. "If we gently square our foreyard, we shall be within 100 yards of her in 10 minutes, and she'll mask us from the ship. Do you see what I mean?"
"Yes, sir."
"With the cutter and the launch full of men, you can take her before she's aware. You make a noise, and the ship bears up to protect her. He has no way on him to tack, he must wear. And if you put the snow before the wind, I can pass through the gap and rake him once or twice as he goes round, maybe knocking away a spar aboard the settee at the same time. On deck there," he called in a slightly louder voice. "Silence on deck. Send those men below." For the rumour had spread, and men were running up the forward hatchway. "The boarder's away, then. We should be best advised to send all our black men. They're fine, lusty fellows, and the Spaniards dread them. The sloop cleared for action with the least possible show, and the men ready to fly to their quarters, but all kept below, out of sight, all but a dozen. We must look like a merchantman." He swung over the edge of the top, his nightshirt billowing round his head. "The frappings may be cut, but no other preparation that can be seen."
"The hammocks, sir?"
"Yes, by God," said Jack, pausing. "We shall have to get them up precious fast if we're not to fight without them. A
damned uncomfortable state. But do not let one come on deck until the boarders are away. Surprise is everything. Surprise. Surprise. Stephen's surprise at being jerked awake with quarters, sir, quarters, and at finding himself in the midst of an extraordinarily intense, muted activity. People hurrying about in almost pitch darkness, not a glim, the gentle clash of weapons secretly handed out, the boarders creeping over the landward side and into the boats by twos and threes, the boatswain's mates hissing, "Stand by! Stand by for quarters! All hands stand by!" in the nearest possible approach to a whispered shout. Warrant officers and petty officers checking their teams, quieting the Sophie's fools. She bore a competent share, who urgently wanted to know what, and why. Jack's voice calling down into the gloom, "Mr. Ricketts! Mr. Babington!"
"Sir?"
"When I give you the word, you and the top men are to go aloft at once. To gallants and courses to be set instantly."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Surprise. The slow, growing surprise of the sleepy watch aboard the Santa Lucia, gazing at this brig as it drifted closer and closer. Did it mean to join company? "She's that Dane who's always plying up and down the coast," stated Jean Wiseacre. Their sudden, total amazement at the sight of two boats coming out from behind the brig and racing across the water. After the first moment's unbelief, they did their best. They ran for their muskets, they pulled out their cutlasses, and they began to cast loose a gun. But each of the seven men acted for himself, and they had less than a minute to make up their minds. So when the roaring Sophies hooked on at the fore and main chains and came pouring over the side, the prize crew met them with no more than one musket shot, a couple of pistols, and a half-hearted clash of swords. A moment later, the four liveliest had taken to the rigging, one had darted below, and two lay upon the deck. Dillon kicked open the cabin door, glared at the young privateer's mate along a heavy pistol, and said, "You surrender?"
"Oui, monsieur,"
quavered the youth. "On deck," said Dillon, jerking his head. "Murphy, Muzzle, Thompson, King, clap onto those hatch covers. Bear a hand now. Davies, Chambers, Wood, start the sheets. Andrews, flatten the jib." He ran to the wheel, heaved a body out of the way, and put up the helm. The Santa Lucia paid off slowly, then faster and faster. Looking over his shoulder, he saw the topgallants break out in the Sophie, and in almost the same moment the foresail, main staysail, and boom mainsail. Ducking to peer under the snow's forecourse, he saw the ship ahead of him beginning to wear, to turn before the wind and come back on the other tack to rescue the prize. There was great activity aboard her. There was great activity aboard the three other vessels of the convoy, men racing up and down, shouts, whistles, the distant beating of a drum. But in this gentle breeze, and with so little canvas abroad, they all of them moved with a dreamlike slowness, quietly following smooth, predestinate curves. Sails were breaking out all over, but still the vessels had no way on them, and because of their slowness he had the strangest impression of silence. A silence broken a moment later, as the Sophie came shaving past the snow's larboard bow with her colours flying, and gave them a thundering cheer. She alone had a fair bow wave, and with a spurt of pride James saw that every sail was sheeted home, taut and drawing already. The hammocks were piling up at an incredible speed. He saw two go by the board, and on the quarterdeck, stretching up over the nettings, Jack raised his hat high, calling, "Well done indeed, sir," as they passed. The boarders cheered their shipmates in return, and as they did so, the atmosphere of terrible, killing ferocity on the deck of the snow changed entirely. They cheered again, and from within the snow, under the hatches, there came a generalized answering howl. The Sophie, all sails abroad,
was running at close on 4 knots. The Gloire had little more than steerage way, and she was already committed to this wheeling movement, was already engaged upon the gradual curve downwind that would turn her unprotected stern to the Sophie's fire. There was less than a quarter of a mile between them, and the gap was closing fast. But the Frenchman was no fool. Jack saw the ship's mizzen topsail laid to the mast, and the main and foreyard squared so that the wind would thrust the stern away to leewards and reverse the movement, for the rudder had no bite at all. "Too late, my friend, I think," said Jack. The range was narrowing. 300 yards? 250? "Edwards," he said to the captain of the aftermost gun, "fire across the Settee's bows." The shot, in fact, went through the Settee's foresail. She started her halyards, her sails came down with a run, and an agitated figure hurried aft to raise his colours and lower them emphatically. There was no time to attend to the Settee, however. "Luff up," he said. The Sophie came closer to the wind. Her foresail shivered once and filled again. The Gloire was well within the forward traverse of the guns. "Thus, thus," he said. And all along the line he heard the grunt and heave, as the guns were heaved round a trifle to keep them bearing. The crews were silent, exactly placed and tense. The spongers knelt with the lighted matches in their hands, gently blowing to keep them in a glow, facing rigidly inboard. The captains crouched, glaring along the barrels at that defenceless stern and quarter. "Fire!" The word was cut off by the roar. A cloud of smoke hid the sea, and the Sophie trembled to her keel. Jack was unconsciously stuffing his shirt into his breeches when he saw that there was something amiss. Something wrong with the smoke. A sudden fault in the wind, a sudden gust from the northeast, sent it streaming down astern, and at the same moment the sloop was taken aback, her head pushed round the starboard. "Hands to the braces!" called Marshall, putting up the helm to bring her back. Back she came, though slowly, and the second broadside roared out. But the gust had pushed the Gloire's stern round too, and as the smoke cleared, so she replied. In the seconds between, Jack had had time to see that her stern and quarter had suffered. Cabin windows and little gallery smashed in, that she carried 12 guns, and that her colours were French. The Sophie had lost much of her way, and the Gloire, now right back on her original larboard tack, was fast gathering speed. They sailed along on parallel courses, close-hauled to the fitful breeze, the Sophie some way behind. They sailed along, hammering one another in an almost continuous din and an unbroken smoke, white, grey-black, and lit with darting crimson stabs of fire. On and on. The glass turned, the bell clanged, the smoke lay thick, the convoy vanished astern. There was nothing to say, nothing to do. The gun captains had their orders, and they were obeying them with splendid fury, firing for the hull, firing as quickly as they could. The midshipmen in charge of the divisions ran up and down the line, bearing a hand, dealing with any beginning of confusion. The powder and shot travelled up from the magazine with perfect regularity. The boatswain and his mates roamed, gazing up for damage to the rigging. In the tops, the sharpshooters' muskets crackled briskly. He stood there reflecting. A little way to his left, scarcely flinching as the balls came whipping in or hulled the sloop, a great rending thump, stood the clerk and Ricketts, the quarter-deck midshipman. A ball burst through the packed hammock netting, crossed a few feet in front of him, struck an iron netting crane and lost its force on the hammocks the other side. An 8-pounder, he noticed, as it rolled towards him. The Frenchman was firing high, as usual, and pretty wild. In the blue, smokeless, peaceful world to windward, he saw splashes as much as 50 yards ahead and astern of them, particularly ahead. Ahead. From the flashes that lit the far side of the cloud and from the change of sound, it was clear that the Gloire was forging ahead. That would not do. "Mr. Marshall," he said, picking up his speaking trumpet, "we will cross under her stern." As he raised the trumpet, there was a tumult and shouting forward. A gun was over on its side, perhaps two. "Avast firing there," he called with great force. "Stand by the larboard guns." The smoke cleared. The Sophie began to turn to starboard, moving to cross the enemy's wake and to bring her port broadside to bear on the Gloire's stern, raking her whole length. But the Gloire was having none of it. As though warned by an inner voice, her captain had put up his helm within 5 seconds of the Sophie's doing so, and now, with the smoke clearing again, Jack, standing by the larboard hammocks, saw him at his taffrail, a small, trim, grizzled man 150 yards away, looking fixedly back. The Frenchman reached behind him for a musket, and resting his elbows on the taffrail, he very deliberately aimed it at Jack. The thing was extraordinarily personal. Jack felt an involuntary stiffening of the muscles of his face and chest, a tendency to hold his breath. "The Royals, Mr. Marshall," he said. "She's drawing away from us." The gunfire had died away as the guns ceased to bear, and in the lull he heard the musket shot part almost as if it had been in his ear. In the same second of time, Christian Pram, the helmsman, gave a shrill roar and half fell, dragging the wheel over with him, his forearm ploughed open from wrist to elbow. The Sophie's head flew up into the wind, and although Jack and Marshall had the wheel directly, the advantage was gone. The port broadside could only be brought to bear by a further turn that lost still more way. The Sophie was a good 200 yards behind the Gloire now, on her starboard quarter. Then the only hope was to gain speed, to range up and renew the battle. He and the master glanced up simultaneously. Everything was set that could be set. The wind was too far forward for the studding sails. He stared ahead, watching for the stir aboard the Chase, the slight change in her wake that would mean a coming movement to starboard. The Gloire, in her turn, crossing the Sophie's stem, raking her fore and aft and bearing up to protect the scattered convoy. But he stared in vain. The Gloire held on to her course. She had drawn ahead of the Sophie even without her royals, but now these were setting and the breeze was kinder to her too. As he watched, the tears brimming over his eyelids from the concentration of his gaze against the rays of the sun, a slant of wind laid her over, and the water ran creaming under her lee, her wake lengthening away and away. The grey-haired captain fired on pertinaciously, a man beside him passing loaded muskets. And one ball severed a ratlin 2 feet from Jack's head. But they were almost beyond musket range now, and in any case the indefinable frontier between personal animosity and anonymous warfare had been passed. It didn't affect him. "Mr. Marshall," he said, "pray edge away until we can salute her. Mr. Pullings? Mr. Pullings, fire as they bear." The Sophie turned 2, 3, 4 points from her course. The bow gun cracked out, followed in even sequence by the rest of the port broadside. Too eager, alas. They were well pitched up, but the splashes showed 20 and even 30 yards astern. The Gloire, more attentive to her safety than her honour, and quite forgetful of her duty to Seigneur Mathieu, the unvindictive Gloire did not yaw to reply, but hauled her wind. Being a ship, she could point up closer than the Sophie, and she didn't scruple to do so. Profiting to the utmost by the favour of the breeze, she was plainly running away. Of the next broadside, two balls seemed to hit her, and one certainly passed through her mizzen topsail. But the target was diminishing every minute as their courses diverged, and hope diminished with it. 8 broadsides later, Jack stopped the firing. They had knocked her about shrewdly, and they'd ruined her looks, but they'd not cut up her rigging to make her unmanageable, nor carried away any vital mast or yard, and they'd certainly failed to persuade her to come back and fight it out yardarm to yardarm. He gazed at the flying Gloire, made up his mind, and said, "We will bear away for the Cape again, Mr. Marshall, south-southwest." The Sophie was remarkably little wounded. "Are there any repairs that will not wait half an hour, Mr. Watt?" he asked, absently hitching a stray slab line round a pin.
"No, sir. The sailmaker will be busy for a while. But she sent us no chain nor bar, and she never clawed our rigging, not to say clawed. Poor practice, sir. Very poor practice. Not like that wicked little old Turk and the sharp raps he give us."
"Then we'll pipe the hands to breakfast and knot and splice afterwards. Mr. Lamb, what damage do you find?"
"Nothing below the waterline, sir. 4 right ugly holes amidships and 2 and 4 gun ports well nigh beat into one. That's the worst. Nothing to what we give her to sodomite," he added, under his breath.
Jack went forward to the dismounted gun. A ball from the Gloire had shattered the bulwark where the aft ring bolts were fastened, just as number 4 was on the recoil. The gun, partly checked on the other side, had slewed round, jamming its run-out neighbour and oversetting. By wonderful good luck, the 2 men who should have been crushed between them were not there. One washing the blood from a graze off his face in the fire bucket, the other hurrying for more slow match. And by wonderful good luck, the gun had gone over rather than running murderously about the deck. "Well, Mr. Day," he said, "we were in luck one way, if not the other. The gun may go into the bows until Mr. Lamb gives us fresh ring bolts." As he walked aft, taking off his coat as he went, the heat was suddenly unbearable, he ran his eye along the southwestern horizon. No sign of Cape Now and the rising haze. Not a sail to be seen. He'd never noticed the rising of the sun, but there it was, well up into the sky. They must have run a surprising long way. "By God, I could do with my coffee," he said, coming abruptly back into a present in which ordinary time flowed steadily once more and appetite mattered. "But, however," he reflected, "I must go below." This was the ugly side. This was where you saw what happened when a man's face and an iron ball met.
"Captain Aubrey," said Stephen, clapping his book to the moment he saw Jack in the cockpit, "I have a grave complaint to make."
"I'm concerned to hear it," said Jack, peering about in the gloom for what he dreaded to see. "They have been at my asp. I tell you, sir, they have been at my asp. I stepped into my cabin for a book not 3 minutes ago, and what did I see? My asp drained. Drained, I say. Tell me the butcher's bill, then I will attend to your asp. Bah! A few scratches, a man with his forearm moderately scored, a couple of splinters to draw, nothing of consequence, mere bandaging. All you'll find in a sick bay is an obstinate gleet with low fever and a reduced inguinal hernia, and that forearm. Now, my asp!" "No dead? No wounded?" cried Jack, his heart leaping up. "No, no, no. Now, my asp!" He had brought it aboard in its spirits of wine, and at some point in very recent time a criminal hand had taken the jar, drunk up all the alcohol, and left the asp dry, stranded, parched. "I'm truly sorry for it," said Jack, "but will not the fellow die? Must he not have an emetic?"
"He will not. That's what's so vexing. The bloody man, the more than hum, the sottish rapparee, he will not die. It was the best double-refined spirits of wine.
Pray come and breakfast with me in the cabin. A pint of coffee and a well-broiled chop between you and the asp will take away the sting. Will appease." In his gaiety of heart, Jack was very near a witticism. He felt it floating there, almost within reach. But somehow it escaped, and he confined himself to laughing as cheerfully as Stephen's vexation would with decency allow, and observing, "The damned villain ran clean away from us, and I'm afraid we shall have but a tedious time making our way back. I wonder whether Dylan managed to pick up the settee, or whether she ran for it too." It was a natural curiosity, a curiosity shared by every man aboard the Sophie, apart from Stephen. But it was not to be satisfied that forenoon, nor yet for a great while after the sun had crossed the meridian. Towards noon the wind fell to something very near a calm. The newly bent sails flapped, hanging in flaccid bulges from their yards, and the men working on the tattered set had to be protected by an awning. It was one of those intensely humid days, when the air has no nourishment in it, and it was so hot that even with all his restless eagerness to recover his boarders, secure his prize, and move on up the coast, Jack couldn't find it in his heart to order out the sweeps. The men had fought the ship tolerably well, though the guns were still too slow by far, and they had been very active repairing what damage the Gloire had inflicted. "I'll let them be at least until the dog watch," he reflected. The heat pressed down upon the sea. The smoke from the galley funnel hung along the deck, together with the smell of grog and the hundredweight or so of salt beef the Sophies had devoured at dinner time. The regular tang-tang of the bell came at such long intervals that long before the snow was seen it appeared to Jack that this morning's sharp encounter must belong to another age, another life, or, indeed, had it not been for the lingering smell of powder in the cushion under his head, to another kind of experience. To a tale, he'd read. Stretched out on the locker under his stern window, Jack revolved this in his mind. Revolved it again, more slowly, and again, and so sank far down and away. He woke suddenly, refreshed, cool, and perfectly aware that the Sophie had been running easily for a considerable time, with a breeze that lent her over a couple of strakes, bringing her heels higher than his head.
"I'm afraid those damned youngsters woke you, sir," said Mr. Marshall with solicitous vexation. "I sent them aloft, but I fear it was too late, calling out and hallooing like a pack of baboons. Damn their capers!"
Although he was singularly open and truthful upon the whole, Jack at once replied, "Oh, I wasn't asleep." On deck he glanced up at the two mastheads where the midshipmen were peering anxiously down to see whether their offence was reported. Meeting his eye, they at once stared away, with a great demonstration of earnest duty, in the direction of the snow and her accompanying settee, rapidly closing with the Sophie on the easterly breeze. "There she is," said Jack inwardly, with intense satisfaction. And he picked up the settee. Good, active fellow, capital seaman. His heart warmed to Dylan. It would have been so easy to let that second prize slip away while he was making sure of the crew of the snow. Indeed, it must have called for extraordinary exertions on his part to pin the two of them, for the settee would never have respected her surrender for a moment.
"Well done, Mr. Dylan," he cried as James came aboard, guiding a figure in a tattered, unknown uniform over the side. "Did she try to run?"
"She tried, sir," said James. "Allow me to present Captain Lahir of the French Royal Artillery." They took off their hats, bowed, and shook hands. Lahir said, "Api," in a low, penetrate tone, and Jack said, "Domestique, monsieur." "The snow was a Neapolitan prize, sir. Captain Lahir was good enough to take command of the French royalist passengers and the Italian seamen, keeping the prize crew under control while we pulled across to take possession of the settee. I'm sorry to say the tartan and the other settee were too far to windward by the time we had secured her, and they have run down the coast. They are lying under the guns of the battery at Almerara."
"Ah.
We'll look into the bay when we have the prisoners across." "Many prisoners, Mr. Dillon?" "Only about 20, sir. Since the Snow's people are allies, they were on their way to Gibraltar."
"When were they taken?"
"Oh, she's a fair prize, sir. A good 8 days since."
"So much the better. Tell me, was there any trouble?"
"No, sir. Oh, very little. We knocked two of the prize crew on the head, and there was a foolish scuffle aboard the settee. A man pistoled. I hope all was well with you, sir."
"Yes, yes. No one killed, no serious wounds. She ran away from us too fast to do much damage. Sailed 4 miles to R3, even without her royals. A most prodigious fine sailor."
Jack had a notion that some fleeting reserve passed across James Dillon's face, or perhaps showed in his voice. But in the hurry of things to be done, prizes to survey, prisoners to be dealt with, he couldn't tell why it affected him so unpleasantly until some 2 or 3 hours later, when the impression was reinforced and at least half defined. He was in his cabin. Spread out on the table was the chart of Cape Nao, with Cape Almerara and Cape Ifach jutting out from its massive underside, and the little village of Almerara at the bottom of the bay between them. On his right sat James, on his left Stephen, and opposite him Mr. Marshall. "What is more," he was saying, "the doctor tells me the Spaniard says that the other settee has a cargo of quicksilver hidden in sacks of flour, so we must handle her with great care."
"Oh, of course," said James Dillon.
Jack looked at him sharply, then down at the chart and at Stephen's drawing. It showed a little bay with a village and a square tower at the bottom of it. A low mole ran 20 or 30 yards out into the sea, turned left-handed for another 50, and ended in a rocky knob, thus enclosing a harbour sheltered from all but the southwest wind. Steep two cliffs ran from the village right round to the northeast point of the bay. On the other side there was a sandy beach all the way from the tower to the southwest point, where the cliffs reared up again. "Could the fellow possibly think I'm shy," he thought, "that I left off chasing because I didn't choose to get hurt and hurried back for a prize?" The tower commanded the entrance to the harbour. It stood some 20 yards to the south of the village and the gravel beach, where the fishing boats were hauled out. "Now, this knob at the end of the jetty," he said aloud, "would you say it was 10 foot high?"
"Probably more. It's 8 or 9 years since I was there," said Stephen, "so I'll not be absolute. But the chapel on it withstands the tall waves and the winter storms."
"Then it'll certainly protect our hull. Now, with the sloop anchored, with a spring on her cable so," running his finger in a line from the battery to the rock and so to the spot, "she should be tolerably safe. She opens as heavy a fire as she can, playing on the mole and over the tower. The boats from the Snow and the settee land at the Doctor's Cove," pointing to a little indentation just round the southwest point, "and we run as fast as ever we can along the shore and so take the tower from behind.
20 yards short of it, we fire the rocket, and you turn your guns well away from the battery, but blaze away without stopping.
Me, sir?
Cried James.
Yes, you, sir.
I'm going ashore. There was no answering the decision of this statement, and after a pause he went on to the detailed arrangements. Let's say 10 minutes to run from the cove to the tower, and
allow 20, if you please,
said Stephen. You portly men of a sanguine complexion often die suddenly from unconsidered exertion in the heat, apoplexy, congestion.
I wish you wouldn't say things like that, Doctor, said Jack in a low tone.
They all looked at Stephen with some reproach, and Jack added, Besides, I'm not portly.
The captain has an uncommon genteel figure, said Mr. Marshall.
The conditions were perfect for the attack. The remains of the easterly wind would carry the Sophie in, and the breeze that would spring up off the land at about moonrise would carry her into the offing, together with anything they managed to cut out. In his long survey from the masthead, Jack had made out the settee and a number of other vessels moored to the inner wall of the mole, as well as a row of fishing boats hauled up along the shore. The settee was at the chapel end of the mole, directly opposite the guns of the tower, 100 yards on the other side of the harbour. I may not be perfect, he reflected, but by God I'm not shy. And if we cannot bring her out, then by God I shall burn her where she lies. But these reflections didn't last long. From the deck of the Neapolitan Snow he watched the Sophie round Cape Almerera in the three-quarter darkness and stand into the bay, while the two prizes, with the boats in tow, bore away for the point on the other side. With the settee already in the port, there was no possibility of surprise for the Sophie, and before she anchored she would have to undergo the fire of the battery. If there was to be a surprise, it would lie with the boats. The night was almost certainly too dark now for the prizes to be seen crossing outside the bay to land the boats in Stephen's Cove beyond the point, one of the few I know where the white-bellied swift builds her nest. Jack watched her going with a tender and extreme anxiety, torn with longing to be in both places at once. The possibilities of hideous failure flooded into his mind. The shore guns. How big were they? Stephen had been unable to tell. Hulling the Sophie again and again, the heavy shot passing through both sides. The wind falling or getting up to blow dead on shore. Not enough hands left aboard to sweep her out of range. The boats all astray. It was a foolhardy attempt, absurdly rash.
Silence fore and aft, he cried harshly. Do you want to wake the whole coast?
He had had no idea how deeply he felt about his sloop. He knew exactly how she'd be moving in. The particular creak of her mainyard in its parrel, the whisper of her rudder magnified by the sounding board of her stern, and the passage across the bay seemed to him intolerably long.
Sir, said Pullings, I think we've the point on our beam now.
You're right, Mr. Pullings, said Jack, studying it through his night-glass. See the lights of the village going one after the other. Port your helm, Algren.
Mr. Pullings,
send a good man into the chains. We should have 20 fathom directly. He walked to the taffrail and called over dark water, Mr. Marshall, we're standing in.
The high black bar of the land, sharp against the less solid darkness of the starry sky. It came nearer and nearer, silently eclipsing Arcturus, then the whole of Corona, eclipsing even Vega high up in the sky. The regular splash of the lead, the steady chant of the man in the weather chains,
by the deep nine, by the deep nine, by the mark seven, and a quarter five, a quarter less five. Ahead lay the pallor of the cove beneath the cliff, and a faint white edge of lapping wave.
Right, said Jack.
And the snow came up into the wind, her foresail backing like a sentient creature.
Mr. Pullings, your party into the launch.
14 men filed fast by him and silently over the side into the creaking boat. Each had his white armband on.
Sergeant Quinn.
The marines followed, muskets faintly gleaming, their boots loud on the deck. Someone was grasping at his stomach. It was Captain Lahire, a volunteer attached to the soldiers, looking for his hand.
Good lucky, he said, shaking it.
Mercy very much, said Jack, adding, Mon Captain, over the side.
And at that moment a flash lit the sky, followed by the deep thump of a heavy gun.
"Is that cutter alongside?" said Jack, his night eyes half blinded by the flash.
"Here, sir," said the voice of his coxswain just beneath him.
Jack swung over, dropped down. "Mr. Ricketts, where's the dark lantern?"
"Under my jacket, sir.
Show it over the stern. Give way."
The gun spoke again, followed almost immediately by two together. They were trying for the range, that was sure, but it was a damned roaring great note for a gun.
"A 36-pounder?"
Peering round, he could see the four boats behind him, a vague line against the loom of the snow and the settee. Mechanically, he patted his pistols and his sword. He had rarely felt more nervous, and his whole being was concentrated in his right ear for the sound of the Sophie's broadside. The cutter was racing through the water, the oars creaking as the men heaved, and the men themselves grunting deep with the effort.
"Row off all,"
said the coxswain quietly. And a few seconds later the boat shot, hissing up the gravel. The men were out and had hauled it up before the launch grounded, followed by the Snow's boat with Mowat, the jolly boat with the boatswain, and the Settee's launch with Marshall. The little beach was crowded with men.
"The line, Mr. Watt," said Jack.
"There she goes,"
said a voice, and seven guns went off, thin and faint, behind the cliff.
"Here we are, sir,"
cried the boatswain, heaving two coils of one-inch line off his shoulder. Jack seized the end of one, saying, "Mr. Marshall, clap onto yours, and each man to his knot." As orderly as though they had been mustering by divisions aboard the Sophie, the men fell into place. "Ready? Ready there? Then tear away." He set off for the point where the beach narrowed to a few feet under the cliff, and behind him, fast to the knotted line, ran his half of the landing party. There was a bubbling, furious excitement rising in his chest. The waiting was over. This was the now itself. They came round the point, and at once there were blinding fireworks before them, and the noise increased tenfold. The tower firing with three, four deep red lances very low over the ground. The Sophie, her brailed-up topsails clear in the irregular flashes that lit up the whole sky, hammering away with a fine, busy, rolling fire, playing on the jetty to send stone splinters flying and discourage any attempt at warping the Settee ashore. As far as he could judge from this angle, she was in exactly the position they'd laid down on the chart, with the dark mass of the Chapel Rock on her port beam. But the tower was farther than he'd expected. Beneath his delight, indeed his something nearer rapture, he could feel his body labouring, his legs heaving him slowly along as his boots sank into the soft sand. He must not fall, he thought, after a stumble. And then again at the sound of a man going down on Marshall's rope. He shaded his eyes from the flashes, looked with an unbelievably violent effort away from the battle, ploughed on and on and on, the pounding of his heart almost choking his mind, hardly progressing at all. But now suddenly it was harder ground, and as though he'd dropped a 10-stone load, he flew along, running, really running. This was packed, noiseless sand. And all along behind him he could hear the hoarse, gasping, catching breath of the landing party. The battery was hurrying towards them at last, and through the gaps in the parapet he could see busy figures working the Spanish guns. A shot from the Sophie, glancing off the chapel rock, howled over their heads. And now an eddy in the breeze brought a choking gust of the tower's powder smoke. Was it time for the rocket? The fort was very close. They could hear the voices loud and the rumble of trucks, but the Spaniards were wholly engrossed with answering the Sophie's fire. They could get a little closer, closer still. They were all creeping now, by one accord, all clearly visible to one another in the flashes and the general glow. "The rocket, Bondon," murmured Jack. "Mr. What?" "The grapnels. Check your arms all." The boatswain fixed the three-pronged grapnels to the ropes. The coxswain planted the rockets, struck a spark onto tinder and stood by cherishing it. Against the tremendous din of the battery, there was a little metallic clicking and the easing of belts. The strong panting lessened. "Ready?" whispered Jack. "Ready, sir," whispered the officers. He bent. The fuse hissed, and the rocket went away, a red trail and a high blue burst. "Come on!" he shouted, and his voice was drowned in a great roaring cheer. "Away! Away!" Running, running! Dumped down into the dry ditch, pistols snapping through the embrasures, men swarming up the ropes under the parapet, shouting, shouting, a bubbling scream. His coxswain's voice in his ear, "Give us your fist, mate." The tearing roughness of stone, and there he was, up, whipping his sword out, a pistol in the other hand. But there was no one to fight. The gunners, apart from two on the ground and another kneeling bent over his wound near the great shaded lantern behind the guns, were dropping one by one over the wall and running for the village. "Johnson! Johnson!" he cried. "Spike up those guns! Sergeant Quinn, keep up a rapid fire! Light along those spikes!" Captain Lahier was beating the locks off the heated 24-pounders with a crowbar. "Better make leap," he said. "Make a leap in the air!" "You savez faire leap in the air?" "Eh, pardi," said Lahier with a smile of conviction. "Mr. Marshal, you and all the people are to cut along to the jetty. Marines form at the landward end, sergeant, firing all the time whether they see anyone or not. Get the settee's head round, Mr. Marshal, and her sails loosed. Captain Lahier and I are going to blow up the fort." "By God," said Jack, "I hate an official letter." His ears were still singing from the enormous bang. A second powder magazine in a vault below the first had falsified Captain Lahier's calculations, and his eyes still swam with yellow shapes from the incandescent leaping half-mile tree of light. His head and neck were horribly painful, from all the left-hand half of his long hair having been burnt off. His scalp and face were hideously seared and bruised. On the table in front of him lay four unsatisfactory attempts, and under the Sophie's lee lay the three prizes, urgent to be away from Mahon on the favourable wind, while far behind them the smoke still rose over Almerera. "Now, just listen to this one, will you?" he said, "and tell me if it's good grammar and proper language. It begins like the others. Sophie at sea. My lord
I have the honour to acquaint you that, pursuant to my orders, I proceeded to Cape Nao, where I fell in with a convoy of 3 sail, under the conduct of a French corvetto of 12 guns. Then I go on to put about the snow, merely touch upon the engagement, where the fling about is alacrity, and come to the landing party. Upon its appearing that the remainder of the convoy had run under the guns of the Almerera battery, it was determined that they should be attempted to be cut out, which was happily accomplished. The battery, a square tower mounting 4 iron 24-pounders, being blown up at 27 minutes after 2, the boats having proceeded to the south-southwest point of the bay. 3 tartans that had been hauled up and chained were obliged to be burnt, but the settee was brought out when she proved to be the Zalak, loaded with a valuable cargo of quicksilver concealed in sacks of flour. Pretty bald, ain't it? However, I go on. The zeal and activity of Lieutenant Dillon, who took His Majesty's sloop, I have the honour to command, in, and kept up an incessant fire on the mole and battery, I am much indebted to. All the officers and men behaved so well that it were insidious to particularise, but I must acknowledge the politeness of Monsieur Lahire of the Royal French Artillery, who volunteered his services in setting and firing the train to the magazine, and who was somewhat bruised and singed. Enclosed is a list of the killed and wounded. John Hayter, Marine, killed. James Nightingale, Seaman, and Thomas Thompson, Seaman, wounded. I have the honour to be my lord, and so on. What do you think of that?
Well, it's somewhat clearer than the last, said Stephen, though I fancy invidious might answer better than insidious.
Invidious, of course. I knew there was something not quite shipshape there. Invidious. A capital word. I dare say you spell it with a V. The Sophie lay off San Pedro. She had been extraordinarily busy this last week, and she was rapidly perfecting her technique, staying well over the horizon by day, while the military forces of Spain hurried up and down the coast looking for her, and standing in at night to play old Harry with the little ports and the coastwise trade in the hours before dawn. It was a dangerous, highly personal way of carrying on. It called for very careful preparation. It made great and continual demands on luck, and it had been remarkably successful. It also made great demands on the Sophie's people, for when they were in the offing, Jack exercised them mercilessly at the guns, and James at the still brisker setting of sails. James was as taut an officer as any in the service. He liked a clean ship, action or no action, and there was no cutting out expedition or dawn skirmishing that didn't come back to gleaming decks and resplendent brass. He was particular, as they said. But his zeal for trim paintwork, perfectly drawing sails, squared yards, clear tops and flemished ropes, was, in fact, surpassed by his delight in taking the whole frail, beautiful edifice into immediate contact with the king's enemies, who might wrench it to pieces, shatter, burn, or sink it. The Sophie's people bore up under all this with wonderful spirit, however, a worn, lean, and eager crew, filled with precise ideas of what they should do the minute they stepped ashore from the Liberty boat, filled, too, with a tolerably precise notion of the change in relations on the quarter-deck. Dillon's marked respect and attention to the captain since Almerera, their walking up and down together, and their frequent consultations, had not passed unnoticed. And, of course, the conversation at the gunroom table, in which the lieutenant spoke in the highest terms of the shore party's action, had at once been repeated throughout the sloop. "Unless my adding is out,"
said Jack, looking up from his paper. "We have taken, sunk, or burnt 27 times our own weight since the beginning of the cruise. And had they all been together, they could have fired 42 guns at us, counting the swivels. That's what the Admiral